Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's all big this week. Huge budget, bailout, new regs for Wall Street, new war policy for Afghanistan, and sandbags on the Red River. President Obama outselling hard this week for his budget and the agenda it would fund.
This budget is inseparable from this recovery because it is what lays the foundation for a secure and lasting prosperity.
Republicans and some centrist Democrats pushing back. Here's Republican Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire.
If you take all the debt run up in this country between George Washington and George W. Bush, all of it, President Obama is suggesting doubling that in 5 years and tripling it in 10 years.
And in Fargo, North Dakota, a desperate fight to hold back the Red River.
There's a lot of us out here moving the sandbags, trying to get them right up to the dikes, and there's more people forming the lines to actually make the dikes.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are you keeping up with all that's in motion this week? On budgets, policy, bailouts, Wall Street rules, Afghanistan. Do you see Obama's America, his vision, emerging here or not? And of course, the president just this morning announcing new policy on Afghanistan and Pakistan.
We need a stronger, smarter, and comprehensive strategy. To focus on the greatest threat to our people, America must no longer deny resources to Afghanistan because of the war in Iraq.
Big stuff in motion on many fronts. Joining us now from Washington is Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. He writes the Capital Journal column. He's co-author of Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power. Jerry, welcome back.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Also from Washington, Chuck Babington, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Chuck, great to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jerry, and Chuck.
There is so much on the table here, but I guess the budget decides in the end what gets funded or doesn't get funded, what happens or doesn't happen. Chuck Babington, can you help us understand at the end of this week, when there's been so much ewing and hawing over the budget, where does this stand? Committees we're headed into a debate next week. You've got drafts of plans from the Senate and the House. There was a lot of pushback, not just from Republicans, but from centrist Democrats this week. Does President Obama have what he wants in these draft budgets or not, Chuck?
Tom, he's off to a good start because we're about to enter actually several weeks of debate, even months, because there's so many elements that are part of the budget, but the details have not been filled in, particularly areas such as health care reform, energy, big changes to energy policies and others. So the budget is really sort of a blueprint and a draft, if you will, that has lots of missing details. The good news for Obama is that it looks like the House and the Senate are going to pass this blueprint generally along. He'll get the main things that he wanted. There are a few nips and tucks that he would have preferred not to have. But all in all, a good start for the president. You're really going to see in the weeks ahead the very tough negotiating about how to work out these things such as health care, and at some point some really hard political decisions that could become very partisan about what rules to use, and that would depend that would decide whether the Republicans can mount a successful filibuster in the Senate.
Jerry Seib, early in the week, Tuesday night, President Obama's second primetime news conference, and the sort of after chatter on that was that he looked like he was kind of up against the wall and maybe ready to compromise, maybe significantly, on both scale and timing of his health care reform goals. Energy with cap and trade seemed to be on the table. At the end of the week, are they still under the knife or not? How do you read it, Jerry?
I think you have to look at what the goal of this budget is. The goal of this budget was to be very aggressive at the very outset of the Obama administration and to put all the president's top priorities in the budget and push the envelope out as far as possible, knowing, I think, that Congress was in this case likely to pull the administration back a little bit. This is in some ways the reverse of the usual Washington game in which often a White House will put some things in knowing that Congress will pump them up. Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, I think they knew Congress was likely to pull them back, and they expect that. So the goal here is to get the big items, an alternative energy program, a cap-and-trade program, a down payment, a big down payment on a health care reform, lots of education money into the budget, get the markers laid down, knowing that the details won't really necessarily survive the way the administration wanted, and that the dollar totals aren't going to necessarily survive. And that's what's happening here. But the point is to get the markers down at the outset of the administration, because in this environment, I think they believe everything's on the table, changes in the air. This is the time to get your foot in the door on all these things and work out the details later.
Jack Beatty, I'm still digging here. I mean, you either have cap and trade or you don't. If you have cap and trade, that's a huge source of revenue for the federal government. That's what Obama described as being the funding for health care reform. Those things seem to be in play, maybe under the knife. How do you see it now, Jack? Does he have the fundamental elements in this budget, after his own Democratic leadership has brought out these drafts, to move ahead, really move ahead with his agenda? Or is this the persistence posture that he's going to have, you know, patience someday, maybe?
He's going to have that with his own party. That's very clear. The budget committee under Kent Conrad has, on the one hand, seemingly hurt the Obama program. They don't want reconciliation. They want to have, in other words, a vote under regular order on the budget.
What does that mean?
Well, that essentially means that if it were under reconciliation, the 50 votes would apply under regular order. Filibuster is possible. The House, in its workup of the budget, says they submits it under reconciliation. 50 votes are enough. The Senate says no. According to Max Baucus, we want health reform to be sustainable, and that means getting a significant number of Republicans on board. Therefore, we're going to do it under regular order. Well, the question is that illusory? What Republicans are going to come on board?
Is there any way they'll get 60-plus votes?
Right. Is Arlen Specter going to come on board? Now we know that he's running behind in Pennsylvania to a right-winger challenging him. Is he apt to come to Obama on this? Doesn't seem like it. Are the two senators from Maine, is that what he's talking about? It's taking a heck of a chance. Now, parliamentary experts say, well, the Democrats can, at the last minute, back out. Because the House has said reconciliation, they can do it under regular order. If it doesn't work out there, they can then go back to the House form. I don't know whether this is possible or not. Meanwhile, of course, Kent Conrad has potentially has taken out the $600 billion that the president put aside for health care, and which was revenue neutral. He's taken that out. And now it looks like a defeat, but he says no, it's really a victory for Obama, because if you left it in, Obama would have to pay for it over the whole program over 5 years. Can't be done. So therefore, the authorizing committees will be able to do it over 10 years. That will allow it to be revenue neutral. All of this is in the air. What does strike me, though, is progressive bloggers who follow this stuff in Talmudic detail are encouraged by what Conrad has done, which throws my notions out the window somewhat. But other people say this business about reconciliation, 50 votes versus 60 votes, is there a strategic mistake here in allowing this to come up under, that is, health care under regular order?
So a lot of detail here, but it ends up really mattering. Chuck Babington, if you take out the 600-plus billion that Obama was looking for to float that health care reform along, how does it float along? If it's not in there, is that a roadblock? Is that the end for it? Is there another way, Chuck? And wasn't that supposed to come from capping carbon emissions and taxing business on their emissions?
Well, I think these decisions have not really been fully made yet. Senator Conrad, who chairs the Senate Budget Committee, says that the markers are in place, that the funding could be available. Cap and trade has not been ruled out, and it has a lot of opposition in both the houses. There's no doubt about that, and I think its chances of passing are not very good. But that doesn't mean that there might not be some type of other mechanism, in the energy area to generate some amount of revenue. Decisions are very unformed at this point. And I was really struck when President Obama came up to the Capitol this week and met with the Senate Democrats, mm-hmm. including Kent Conrad, mm-hmm. and the senators came out there, and it was a kumbaya. I mean, they all seemed so happy and really minimized their differences as though they were very, very small. And I think the reason they can do that is because these types of nitty-gritty decisions, they've just not gotten to them yet. They've punted them down the road.
Jerry Seib, if it comes to it, do you see any way President Obama can get 60 votes in the Senate, including the Republicans, that would require, if that's the form in which it comes to the floor, and still have his agenda kind of intact?
I think it's very difficult, but I think the most difficult thing for him right now appears to be a cap-and-trade emissions control system. That's the most difficult one and the one on which there is least consensus. The problem with that is that the money that was supposed to generate in terms of fees paid by mm-hmm. carbon emitters mm-hmm. Was supposed to pay for the furtherance of the Obama middle-class tax cut. So where does the money come to do that? I think health care, there's more of a consensus to do something on health care. The problem, again, is the financing of it. You know, there was supposed to be $300 billion in cost savings
right.
and $300 billion in tax money on higher-income Americans by changing the way they can or can't deduct items on their taxes.
Right,
well,
right.
that's not very popular either in Congress. But that doesn't mean there's not a desire to find some other way to tweak the tax code to pay for health reform. So mm-hmm. I guess the bottom line for me is I still think there's a fighting chance to get something done on health care this year. I think the odds of getting cap and trade done are much longer right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, budget battles with Obama's agenda on the line, bailout and new rules for Wall Street, and a way forward maybe in Afghanistan. We're joined by Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal in Washington, Chuck Babington with the Associated Press there. Jack Beatty is with us as well. A lot of heat over all the spending and deficits. A lot of push by President Obama this week for his agenda. On Wednesday, here's New Hampshire Republican Judd Gregg lashing out at the Obama budget proposal. Ranking member, Republican of the Senate Budget Committee, told CNN he's opposed to the budget's allowance for large amounts of debt in the future.
Because of the fact that it puts on the books a massive amount of debt, it doubles our national debt in 5 years, triples it in 10 years. And as far as the eye can see, essentially it's running deficits of over $1 trillion a year, and you just can't afford that. We get up to it's a technical term, but we get up to a public debt ratio to GDP of 80%, which is about twice what most people think is sustainable. And if we maintain that level, which is projected in the president's budget, you're running a banana republic is what it comes down to. You can't afford to pay those debts.
Senate Budget Committee Chairman Kent Conrad said Wednesday that his office has been hard at work revising the Obama budget proposal. North Dakota Democrats said they have been sensitive to the president's intentions and have made progress.
I've cut $608 billion from what the deficits would otherwise have been. These are real changes, not just my saying so, but scored by the Congressional Budget Office.
$608 billion cut, says Kent Connor, but then we're talking trillions in deficit and a big agenda to go with it. Let's begin to hear from our listeners in Detroit, Michigan. Tony. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Point man Tom, how goes the battle today?
Well, I think it's okay. What do you make of what you see, Tony?
You know, I'm not happy. I'm not a partisan guy. So, you know, just sitting back and looking at all this, you know, I got some questions and I'm not hearing anybody answer them. You know, I'm seeing these trillions of dollars come out. It's all borrowed money. They're using it as capital. But once that's gone, who pays for it? And the generous projections that they're using to make this budget, and they're exactly that, projections, what happens if that changes next year? So I'm not hearing anybody really talk about anything except facts and figures. I hear Obama say that Detroit's got to make hard choices and make some changes.
Yep.
I'm not seeing any changes in Washington. I don't understand how you could generate money out of thin air and call it capital, and then use it as capital and act like when the money's gone that you're still going to have this capital.
Tony, we're going to look right at that. The president, of course, saying that he wants to lay a foundation for a new era, a different kind of economic growth. But that deficit bothering you, and not just you. Ned in Afton, Virginia, you're on the air, Ned.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd just like to express my support for President Obama and the Obama administration and encourage them to fight back in the media against his opponents who are using these huge numbers. They just say trillions or 3 trillion or 8 trillion or mm-hmm. billions of dollars to inform the public what these figures mean. I'm going to give you an example,
okay.
and I'll listen on the radio.
Yep.
If you took 153 million workers of the United States of America, you can pay off $1 trillion in 30 years at $36 a month. And that pays back a 5.2% interest, which the Chinese would love to take that.
Ned, I don't know about those numbers, but I get the perspective that you're coming from the angle that we need change. This is the investment that's required, and we can do it. We can afford it. Let me take it to our panel. Jerry Seib, how about it? What's the White House explanation for what happens with he wants to spend the trillions to rebuild an economy that's in trouble, infrastructure and more that has problems, bring reform, and then how's the payback work, Jerry? Is it like George Bush, who said his policy would produce such growth that all the deficits would be taken care of? Of course, they weren't.
It's something like that. I mean, the key here is growth, economic growth, and the White House explanation of the scary numbers are that those are the scary numbers 5 to 10 years out, and who knows, that if we are right, and you both you stop the recession, you stop the bleeding, and you create growth, and you use this money for alternative energy, which generates a whole new industry, and
right.
a healthcare system that doesn't drag the economy down, that when you come out of the recession, you come out of it with a much healthier, more sustainable economy. That produces real economic growth that's sustainable, and that takes care of the deficits. And, you know, that if that's true, that may very well be right. You know, you remember how fast the deficit disappeared during the Clinton years and
mm-hmm.
how rapidly the country went from federal budget deficit to federal budget surplus. So
mm-hmm.
That can happen, and that's what's supposed to happen. The problem is if it doesn't, you know, the deficit numbers are, in fact, going to be very scary. So it's a gamble, but that's the nature of the gamble, and that's the plan the White House is pursuing.
So, Chuck Babington, if Kent Conrad, for example, Democratic senator from North Dakota, if he's dragging his feet, does that mean he doesn't believe the growth will emerge from these investments, as the president calls them, in the economy?
No, he doesn't say that. Again, for the most part, he's very much in sync with President Obama. I think in the big scheme of things, he does think that the president's budget called for somewhat too much spending, and so he and the others on his committee have proposed to trim that back somewhat. But I think in the biggest scheme of things, they are more or less in sync. You know, Tony. You know, he made points that we hear quite a bit. I would take some issue. He said that Washington's not changing, but you know, first of all, we certainly have a new president. The voters changed that, but also, I mean, Congress is weighing into almost uncharted waters here. I mean, these are huge pieces of legislation. As Jerry said, it's all a gamble, but that's because the economy is in such a mess. And you know, I think just sort of the feeling is that nibbling on the margins would not be enough, so that there's actually a dramatic amount of change going on. And Tony's right that these are all projections, but that's what you have to do, you know, when you're looking into the future.
But if they go through,
so I mean,
we're talking about a kind of a remade American landscape here if it all goes through.
There's a lot of change going on. It's scary.
Scary, maybe necessary, but at the same time, scary. Let's go to Jim in Jericho, Vermont. Jim, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hear a lot of anger or the disbelief or bad language directed at the president and his plan. And what I find myself most disappointed in or disappointed with is the Congress as a whole not working together on what they so frequently call the people's business. It seems to me that ever since the whole herd of them genuflected to George Bush and gave him carte blanche in Iraq, that very, very few of them have been willing to stand for what the country needs as a whole, rather than their own little earmarks and special interests. And I'm becoming angrier and angrier about that.
You saw carte blanche for George Bush and maybe wish there was a little more of that for Obama in your view, Jim.
Well, maybe a little more for that, but a little more getting off their tusks and doing something for the country.
Jim, let us pick it up. Jack Beatty, I'm reading here, Katrina Vandenhoevel in The Nation, firing from the left. She says the fight is on. If Obama wins, you'll see a new era of progressive governance. She says the fight is on. You could see it in those Democrats turning tail and fixating on deficits instead of investment. She clearly doesn't like that, but those deficits are intimidating, Jack.
They are, and, Jim is wrong about one thing. The Congress people don't represent the country. They don't think of themselves that way, at least. They represent their districts, and districts will differ on this, and especially when it comes to the cap-and-trade bill. There you see a strong resistance from brown Democrats from states that put up a lot of effluent in the atmosphere who just are going to fight him there on the basis of their own districts.
Well, I hope some of them are thinking about the whole country and even their districts. At some point, it all comes around, doesn't it?
You would certainly think the climate all comes around, but I think that that particular bill is going to have lots of trouble just because of the difference between the national interest, you might almost say the cosmic interest, and the district and state interest. Blue Dog Democrats who won in areas where Republicans have usually thrived are going to be very, very chary of going ahead with cap and trade. Senators like Evan Bayh from Indiana already almost talking like climate change deniers as they line up against it. That's going to be very, very difficult for the president just because of this difference between the local and the national.
Let's get a call from Dawn in Iowa City, Iowa. Dawn, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I fully support President Obama's budget, and I believe that what he is trying to do with that budget is overturn policies of the past 20 years that have redistributed wealth to the top 5%, probably the top 1% in this country. I think his budget will turn that around and help equalize wealth distribution in the country.
And you're for
it. I don't
think
we can afford not to do it.
Yep, we hear you, Dawn. Thank you very much for your call. Jerry Seib, what about it? A lot of attention. It was certainly in the week of bonus fever, a lot of attention on big money. But for years now, about the way that wealth is skewed in this country, do you see in this budget remaining a redistributive juggernaut coming, Jerry?
Well, I think there are definitely redistribution elements to this budget. I mean, for example, if the cap and trade program that the president wants goes into effect, it would take taxes, essentially, or fees paid by carbon emitters and recycle those in the form of middle class tax cuts. So wealth would certainly be moved around if the health care plan is to be paid for. It would be paid for by limiting the tax deductions of very upper income Americans by limiting their ability to deduct items on their income taxes. So income would move from wealthier Americans into a health care system. So sure, that's the point. I think the bigger question, and my friend E.J. Dionne, who writes a column for the Washington Post, had an interesting column this week in which he raised the broader question, which is, in the long run, can you do all of this without eventually having to raise taxes even on those 95% of Americans below the very top tier that the president has pledged to protect? In other words, can you do all of this just on the back of the very most wealthy Americans? Or eventually, and maybe there's a need for honesty about this, is there going to be a bigger tax burden for everybody if these goals are the goals everybody chooses to pursue?
Walking back a little from the middle class tax cut already, it's only in there for a couple of years, as I understood it, at some point during this week in these new budget proposals, right?
That's right. And this is not something that the president had proposed. But because the especially senators such as Kent Conrad and other Democratic lawmakers who are concerned about the big deficit numbers that we're projecting are looking for ways to curb that somewhat. So even though, a principal tenet of Obama's campaign was to, just as Dawn said, to roll back the tax cuts for the very high income people that happened under President Bush, Now they're having to temper that somewhat because they're concerned about the first of all, you know, the tax that you shouldn't be cutting. Raising taxes at any on anyone during a bad economic time, but these numbers just are not working out that well. And so, as Jerry said, the juggernaut, if there ever was a juggernaut, towards a redistribution is not really it's slowing down quite a bit.
Let's look at Timothy Geithner's big agenda this week, talking about dealing with toxic assets and a public-private partnership. We'll look at that, but also talking about new regulations for Wall Street. In front of a House Financial Services hearing yesterday, the Treasury Secretary called for comprehensive regulatory reform of the nation's financial institutions, said that although some regulations were already in place, sweeping, permanent changes are needed.
The U.S. came into this crisis without adequate tools to manage it effectively. And as I discussed before this committee on Tuesday, U.S. law left regulators without good options for managing the failure of systemically important, large, complex financial institutions. To address this will require comprehensive reform, not modest repairs at the margin, but new rules of the game. And the new rules must be simpler and more effectively enforced.
Simpler and more effectively enforced. Jerry Seib, you saw the big rollout yesterday from the Secretary of Treasury. Of course, he's out of the New York Fed. He knows Wall Street well. What kind of reaction, first of all, are we seeing from Wall Street hedge funds and others who may see new regulation here? Are they running, you know, barring the door, welcoming?
Well, I don't think they're welcoming, but I don't think they're surprised either. My sense is that people in Wall Street knew that one of the inevitable outcomes of this was some different and somewhat more burdensome regulatory regime. And I think that what Secretary Geithner did this week was at least along the lines of what they expected. And he's trying to do three things here, really. Mm-hmm. One is to sort of broaden the universe of financial institutions that are, in fact, regulated, to bring in hedge funds and insurance companies and people who do derivative trades, non-bank financial institutions that kind of look like banks but aren't really. Mm-hmm. And the second is to find a regulator for those that can look out for what people call systemic risk. That is to say, risks that are so big or institutions that are so big that their demise could drag down significant parts of the economy, that they pose a risk that goes well beyond themselves if they fail, to have a regulator, and it's probably going to be the Federal Reserve, that is on the lookout for that and that has the information at hand to do something about that. And then third, to create a mechanism so that the government can move in and wind down one of these failing institutions in an orderly way, sort of the way the FDIC winds down a failing bank so that people are protected as it goes down. There's nothing like that right now, and that's why AIG is such a problem. And the goal here is to create a mechanism, and it's probably the FDIC, that can move in and take over and do the demise of a big non-bank financial institution in an orderly way. I think those are the big elements, and I think most people saw them coming in some form or another.
Chuck, we'll come to you and ask how those are likely to hit Congress and be received there, how they may emerge on the other side. But, Jack, what about the shape of what you're hearing from Tim Geithner? Does it look like a new day, look like the regulation there have been so many calls for?
It looks like some of it. Other people might argue that let these institutions get too big to fail in the first place. Let's have a more active antitrust component to this. I think that's what Paul Krugman and others are getting at when they fear that these new regulations leave too much of the landscape of mass securitization intact. Simon Johnson, the British economist, has been calling for a much more active antitrust thrust here to create institutions that won't get into this position, so that won't need this kind of massive intervention.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. A tornado in Mississippi this week. The Secretary of State talks drugs and President Obama talking all over. A powerful tornado rocked Mississippi yesterday. Here's one man from McGee whose house was wrecked right around him.
Started hailing and just we started hearing a big roar. And the next thing I knew, just all of a sudden, I was just outside.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in Mexico this week. She said Americans share responsibility for the drug war south of the border.
Our demand for drugs is what motivates these drug gangs. I mean, if they didn't think they were going to make a bunch of money across the border, they'd go into another line of work.
And President Obama seemed to be everywhere this week. Late night funny man Craig Ferguson was thinking Octomom.
He's on TV a lot these days, Obama. The only way Obama could get more time on TV is if he had eight babies.
We're looking at a week in the news. Jerry Seib is here from the Wall Street Journal. Chuck Babington from the Associated Press. Jack Beatty's here. Going to look at Afghanistan in just a moment. But Chuck Babington, first to you on this issue of what Congress is likely to do with Treasury Secretary Geithner's proposals on regulating Wall Street. Do you see Congress backing him up? You know, we have learned that all it takes is a few kind of late night, you know, wrinkles snuck into the text, and there can be all kinds of doors open.
That's certainly true, Tom. The initial reaction seemed to be pretty good. Certainly the reaction of Wall Street was good. You know, the Democrats hold pretty good majorities in the House and the Senate, and so the general reception to overtures by President Obama tend to be good. Secretary Geithner has had some rough spots over the last few weeks, as we know. He seemed to be finding his footing a little bit, and the I think this rollout did not seem to trigger any loud criticisms from Democrats. So I think at least it's off to a good start, and you know the members of Congress are very eager to find some type of fix. The very strong anger over the AIG bonuses died down a little bit. I thought that was very interesting because from a purely populist political standpoint, you know, raising the pitchfork seemed to be playing pretty well, and Obama and others got the members of Congress to calm down a little bit over that. So I think Geithner is off to a good start on this point.
Jerry Seib, a pretty good bump on Wall Street this week in the markets. Now, does that mean that Wall Street thinks that some new regime of regulation is palatable, it's all right, maybe even good for a new round of growth, or not? Also, some down indicators this week. Consumer spending in February, down again.
Right. And it's hard to know exactly what logical conclusions to draw from what the market does on any given week. But I think the bigger factors this week were a sense that not the regulatory regime was important, but that there's finally out there a Treasury plan to buy to create a mechanism to buy bad assets and take them off the books of big banks. And that was a long time coming. And I'm not sure people are optimistic it's going to work, but at least it's started. So that was factor number one. And factor number two is that you actually in the real world see some faint signs of a stabilization in the economy. You know, new housing sales were pretty good this week, for example. The growth in unemployment wasn't quite as bad as some people feared, that sort of thing. Not, you know, nothing that you would strike up the band for, but things that show that maybe a real bottom in this recession is coming if it's not already here, and the market's trying to get out in front of that a little bit. That all obviously works to Tim Geithner's benefit. It was at least a sign that Wall Street thought the bank bailout details that he put out were at least plausible and that they had some reason, there was some reason to think they would work.
Mm. Let's go to Jack, yeah.
Well, I was going to say plausible but opaque. Here from the invaluable Michael Kinsley is a passage from the document released this week by the Treasury on the public-private partnerships. Quote, private investors may be given voluntary withdrawal rights at the level of a private vehicle, subject to limitations to be agreed with Treasury, including that no private investor may have the right to voluntarily withdraw from a private vehicle prior to the third anniversary of the first investment of such private vehicle. Now, that piece of voodoo, I think, is all too emblematic of part of the problem with this plan. It is so clever. It is so and so morally dubious. Let's face it. It's going to be the government is going to go into business with and profit many of the people who have put this economy into such a terrible position. It's going to be a politically extremely difficult for the Obama administration as more and more companies to which the government is giving subsidies continue to give bonuses to their employees. And it's going to be it could in fact weaken any further effort to get money from Congress. This public-private deal. I mean, my only hope for it is that it really is a way of showing the Congress we've done everything we can under this idea of keep the private into it. It's not working. You can see it's not working. The banks aren't giving up these assets at any price we can do. Therefore, we have to move to some form of partial nationalization. We've done everything else. If that's not the rationale, it's hard to see the plan working, although you can't deny that the initial reaction from Wall Street was favorable.
And the president turning around some of that pitchfork rhetoric this week, saying in his Tuesday appearance that we can't afford to demonize every investor and entrepreneur who seeks to make a profit. Sort of cool your jets message in a way on that front. Let's go to Duke in Savannah, Georgia. Duke, you're on the air.
We were talking about the budget, and I really feel like one of the problems that we're facing is a cultural issue, and the change is a cultural change that we've been borrowing money so long, and our friends and neighbors are borrowing this money, and I mean it just seems like it's time to pay it back. But the fear of it has been building up in our culture so long that we're having a difficult time to deal with it.
You mean we're used to it, like a family carrying a big credit card balance? We've just gotten used to it. You mean, Duke?
Absolutely. We've put it off and put it off, and it's time to bite the bullet. So yeah, the budget could be scary, but still, at the same point, we got ourselves into it, and it's just time to pay the piper in kind of a way.
But then there's the question, is it time to bite the bullet, or the Keynesians say time to keep spending and get out of the trench, at least for now? Let's go to Fred in Lansing, Michigan. Fred, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
The thing that I'm really concerned about is the duplicity, I guess I'd have to say, of especially the conservatives. In this issue, I'm a big supporter of what Obama's doing. I think he's headed the right direction. I think it has to be a shockwave action to get jobs going for people. And I just want to remind people, I'm from Michigan here,
mm-hmm.
and I know of a lot of people, my in-laws migrated here from the South when there weren't jobs down there after the Depression, and they got great jobs, and we won World War II, and then now we're using the German and Japanese labor standards. It's what the gentleman was saying earlier about all politics being local. If you've got a BMW factory or a Toyota factory in your district, then you want to set the wages according to their standards. They ought to be setting the standards wages according to Detroit standards. And I'm not a protectionist. I think there ought to be good competition. But I don't see why a foreign company should come in and dictate wages when we've had a great economy based on the automobile. And the people from the West Coast, Nancy Pelosi, I'm a Democrat, and Nancy Pelosi makes me angry every time she belittles our automobile industry, which really helped us have all the freedom we have in this country now. And I just want to stand up and speak out for our automobile industry here in Michigan.
Fred, we hear it loud and clear. Chuck Babington, how about Nancy Pelosi? I don't know, vis-a-vis the Obama White House and maybe Rahm Emanuel. I mean, the talk was Rahm Emanuel was supposed to be the whipcracker. He'd have, Congress in line. Is that working? Or in the House, at least, is Speaker Pelosi really the boss?
Speaker Pelosi has a weekly news conference on Thursdays. I went to it yesterday. She seemed like a pretty happy lady. She's very much in sync with Obama, generally speaking. There was no secret that, even though she did not come out publicly during the campaign, that she preferred Obama over Hillary Clinton. A lot of that had to do with the Iraq War issue. But Speaker Pelosi is a powerful politician. She controls the House largely because of a liberal slant to the Democratic caucus, and that's where she comes from. She has to moderate that group all the time to not get too far out to the left, and she understands that. But I think that with very few exceptions, the Speaker is quite happy with the changes at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and is very much in sync with the president. And as we were talking about earlier, she is very much behind this idea of using all the powers of congressional rules to move this budget and the health care reforms through Congress, even if it means over on the other side of the Capitol, taking away, basically, effectively taking away the filibuster rights of the Republicans. Of course, that's easier for her to say because she's not in the Senate.
Mm. I want to talk about Afghanistan policy coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue just today. The president talking about more troops going in there, looking on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border. Here he is talking about the connection between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
To enhance the military, governance, and economic capacity of Afghanistan and Pakistan, we have to marshal international support. And to defeat an enemy that heeds no borders or laws of war, we must recognize the fundamental connection between the future of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Jerry Saib, what did you hear in the president's remarks today? Do you see a big turn here in policy, a big crank-up, a modest crank-up in American presence there, Jerry?
I think a modest crank-up, but a significant one. You know, the president today was talking about sending 4,000 more military trainers to Afghanistan on top of the 17,000 additional troops he had already ordered be sent there. The goal of the 17,000 is really to secure better that border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The goal of the 4,000 is to start building an Afghan army, which the president said ought to get up to 134,000 troops, that can actually stand up and do some reasonable security measures of its own. Those are all important things. I think what people probably paid less attention to, but that my sense is people in the administration think is equally important, was this plea to help the Pakistani government send a significant amount of aid to Pakistan, because that country has been hit very hard by the global economic slowdown. It has further destabilized an already not-so-stable government there, and that's a big worry. And secondly, to send a lot more American civilians to Afghanistan to build up some civilian institutions in that country that can make that a more stable place. I think in the minds of people in the administration that I've talked to, those are at least as important as the troops on the ground are going to be if this is going to work.
Jack, also $1.5 billion in here for Pakistan, which has been such an uncertain partner in this whole project. And talk about Predator drones, maybe one day soon, firing missiles into Balochistan, Quetta, where Taliban leaders are said to be hiding out. That's pretty populated territory. That certainly would be a ratchet up.
It certainly would, and it would destabilize Pakistan. I'm very sorry to see the president take this turn, really. I mean, he the campaign got him into it. He was against Iraq. He had to be for Afghanistan. And yet, in some ways, the putting in of U.S. troops in Afghanistan was a bigger mistake than into Iraq. We have no vital interest at stake at all in Afghanistan. At least in Iraq, there was oil. Bismarck once said, "The Balkans aren't worth the bones of a single Pomeranian grenadier." You could say the same thing about the bones of a single American soldier for Afghanistan.
But what about home to Al Qaeda?
Yes, well, of course, now that it has a home, it's called Pakistan. And it's protected, as we know, by the Pakistan intelligence services, that is, Al Qaeda is, and the Taliban. And where does the, you know, after all, the model is, if they build a terrorist training camp, somehow that's where the problem will come from. Well, that you can destroy it from the air. Anyway, the problem isn't from a terrorist training camp. It's from plots. It's from people's ideas. It's from their ideologies. The people that struck us came from Hamburg, Germany.
Finally,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Finally,
and we're all involved in this illusion that we've got to somehow stop terrorism in Afghanistan, when terrorism can happen in Hamburg, it can happen in London, it can happen anywhere. And I'm just terribly sorry to see the president go down this path of a small but I think significant escalation in Afghanistan.
Chuck Babington, do you see Congress lining up behind the president on his Afghan-Pakistan initiative here?
Somewhat nervously, Tom, the economy has just so dominated Congress and its thinking in the past few weeks that there's not been much focus on this. And I think maybe in the coming weeks and months there will be more of this. Certainly, the administration does not agree with Jack's analysis there. They do talk more about the ties to Afghanistan and 9/11, and they see it as a more direct threat. There are, but there is a significant number of particularly liberal Democrats, in, particularly in the House, that are quite nervous about this. They've not said much yet, but I would look in the next few weeks and months for this to become a more prevalent issue.
And finally, I don't want to end this hour without marking the death this week of historian, great historian, and chronicler of American race relations, John Hope Franklin. We've got a little tape right here of a conversation, a bit from a conversation I had with him in 2005 on this show, where John Hope Franklin spoke in personal terms about his struggle with race in America.
I never was able to escape race. Race is so permeating in this, in the climate in this country. I refer to this country as a racial jungle. There was never a time, even when I was 6 or when I was 12 or when I was 20 or when I was 80, never a time when I didn't, when I was able to escape the specter and the curse of race. It's pervasive in the United States.
There was never a time he could escape it, he said. And now, of course, Jack Beatty, John Hope Franklin is gone. Of course, that was 2005, before Barack Obama was elected president. Just got a few seconds, Jack. But final thoughts on John Hope Franklin?
Well, he was a great scholar and a moral hero. He refused service in World War II because he said he would not fight for a country that had no respect for me and little interest in my well-being. A moral hero and someone who's made a great contribution to American life and letters.
John Hope Franklin, gone this week. Gerald Seib with The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining us looking back on this week. And thanks for joining us in this hour, Jerry.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. And Chuck Babington, great to hear from you again. Thanks for joining us, Chuck.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. This is On Point.